I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive writing. upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Joel Lewis, who has been a staff writer at NJPAC in Newark, New Jersey Performing Arts Center, is the author of many books, including Learning from New Jersey and House Rent Boogie, who has edited an anthology of New Jersey poets, and is to me, crucially, the editor of Reality Prime, Selected Poems of Walter Lowenfels. And by Daisy Freed, author of My Brother is Getting Arrested Again, 2006, and She Didn't Mean to Do It, 2000. Both those titles put smiles on everybody's faces. Both from University of Pittsburgh Press, has taught at Smith, Haverford, Bryn Mawr, Villanova, Temple, here at Penn and elsewhere, has blogged for Harriet, the Poetry Foundation blog, and was a 2006 Guggenheim Fellow. And by Ron Silliman, who has written and edited more than 30 books, including The Alphabet, a 1,000-plus page poem in 26 parts, each titled after a letter of that aforementioned writing system, The Alphabet, composed and published between 1979 and 2004, who is now engaged in another big project called Universe, whose essays, especially Disappearance of the Word, Appearance of the World, and The New Sentence, have been widely republished and discussed and taught, and whose eponymous blog has been visited a number of times, well into the millions. And those of us who follow it, it's somewhere like the McDonald's sign, right? How many millions?
3.5.
Not 3.5 billion, but 3.5 million. That's a lot, Ron. And who, after moving from the Bay Area to Philly in 1995, has been a consistent member of our writing community here at the Writer's House, I'm pleased to say. So welcome to the Writer's House for the first time, Joel. Is this your first visit?
Yes, it is. Thanks for having
Glad to have you. Thanks for making the trip down from Hoboken, is that right? And welcome back to the Writer's House, Ron and Daisy. And Ron, thank you for all your efforts as a Writer's House fellow these past few days.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Daisy, your old haunt here.
It's great to be back.
So today we've gathered here to talk about Paul Blackburn, specifically a poem written in 1960. It's called Seventh Game, 1960 Series. Our recording of the poem was made during a reading Blackburn gave at SUNY Cortland in upstate New York on April 1st, 1971, just prior to baseball's opening day that year. Or maybe on opening day, I didn't look it up. Including Blackburn's introductory comments, the reading lasts 2 minutes and 38 seconds. So here now is Paul Blackburn reading Seventh Game, 1960 Series.
I may as well do this for the... opening of the season. We're already beginning to it sounds like the bleachers, doesn't it? Anyway, it's a game. This is a game. It's the seventh game of the 1960 series, in which Pittsburgh took the New York Yankees. That was the end of the Yankees. They're now an underdog team. I just saw the Mets beat them, you know. In the 12th inning, no less. The Mets got 3 runs in the 12th inning. Unbelievable. Can't believe those Mets anymore. Anyway, this was the seventh game in the 1960 series when the Yankees were still on top. It's for Joel Oppenheimer. Nice day, sweet October afternoon. Men walk the sunshot avenues, second, third, eyes intent elsewhere, ears communing with transistors and shirt pockets. Bars are full, quiet, discussion during commercials only. Pirates lead New York 4-1, top of the 6th, 2 Yankees on base, 1 man out. What a nice day for all this. Handsome women, even dreamy jailbait, walk nearly neglected. Men's eyes are blank, Their thoughts are all in Pittsburgh. Last half of the ninth, the score tied 9-all. Mazeroski leads off for the Pirates. The second pitch, he simply, sweetly, crack, belts it clean over the left field wall. Blocks of afternoon, acres of afternoon, Pennsylvania turnpikes of afternoon. One diamond stretches out in the sun, the third base line, and what men come down, it. The final score, 10-9. Yankees come home.
So there are three moments when the audience laughs. One is when he does something in his introduction that we don't quite know what it is because we don't have a video of it. And none of us was there, I guess. The second is the somewhat delayed, I think, laughter at their thoughts are all in Pittsburgh. And then finally the punchline, Yankees go home, Yankees go home. Does anybody want to talk about any of those three moments of laughter, Daisy?
Well, I think the most important one is Yankees come home, but... Okay.
Do we want to say the obvious thing so about
maybe,
that?
Yeah, well, Castro's just invaded... Or not invaded Cuba, but taken over Cuba the year before, and Eisenhower's messing around in Guatemala, and
it
so
says,
it's a way
come
of,
home though, not
but
go
it says
home.
Come home. So the Yankees have just lost the game,
right?
And so is this kind of climax of defeat there?
Yeah,
you know, which is
the end of what, Daisy?
The end of the game,
and
the end of. The beginning of the end of American imperialism? I don't know.
Well, I mean, in baseball terms, yes. I mean, in baseball terms, Joel, it's the end of what? He even says it in the introduction. It marks the end of what?
Yankees dominance.
Yeah, the empire of the Yankees, right?
Yeah.
So it's actually a pretty smart analogy he's got going. You want to say more about laughter? Or?
Well, I wanted to say more about Cuba because I did a little research and... That whole summer is really the summer of Castro nationalizing. Amiri Baraka, in July of that summer, middle of the baseball season, goes off with a group of delegates from the Fair Play for Cuba committee and comes back and writes a famous essay. I think it was an Evergreen Review a short while later.
Right.
And a week after the World Series ends, begins the blockade. So I'm sure if you looked at the newspaper all summer long, it would have been Cuba, Cuba, and written by a poet who was a significant translator from the Spanish.
Right, so he's very involved in the Spanish language culture. He's politically interested, and he's a baseball fan, and this seemed like the perfect occasion to say something about that. Ron, your thoughts about either Cuba or the laughter?
Well, you know, the interesting element on the laughter for me, I mean, I understand that the Yankees come home, and I think there are levels of droll irony there that are worth appreciating sort of one after another. But in Their Thoughts Are All in Pittsburgh has a lot to do with the presentness and absent-mindedness or absent consciousness of men in New York City, because this is really much more a portrait of men listening to baseball game than it is just people listening to a baseball game. And he finds it noteworthy, and the audience finds it laughworthy, that the men are not watching what in Blackburn's poetry they so often are watching, which is the women, but are
maybe
in fact
even the young women.
Right. They're in the very young women, but their minds are off in Pittsburgh listening to transistor radios, which were the little iPads
in
of
bars,
the day, or watching
right?
televisions in bars, and only talking during the commercials.
Right.
Back in a point
so
in time
a certain
when
reverence.
There wasn't anything like the level of media attention to a sporting event there is today.
So why did the Cortland group, presumably a lot of college people, maybe college-age people, why did they wait? They're laughing at the dreamy jailbait only when they realize it's a little safer to laugh at the line about the men not paying attention even to them. Daisy, your thoughts on this?
Because
you nodded when I said there was a delay to laugh.
I didn't really understand the laughter. And the first thing I thought
nervous,
of that laughter
maybe?
Was, Where is Cortland in relation to the
it's
urban?
It's near Ithaca. It's on the way to
urban,
Ithaca.
Right? Yeah.
No, it's not urban at all.
These are not New Yorkers laughing at.
Well,
you know,
a lot of New Yorkers
city.
Students up there yeah. at yeah. that time would be a lot of suburban and urban New York City.
Yeah, I mean,
people,
this
Joel.
Is where kids from downstate go to get away from their parents, is to go as far north as you can. Actually, one of his students at the time was the poet Bert Kimmelman. Uh-huh. Who went there to become a gym teacher. This is what
who
he
went
told
to SUNY Cortland.
To become a gym teacher and became a poet. And every time
and
I see...
And is now a poet of New Jersey.
Now that I see him, I always know I'm imagining him with a little whistle and a gray sweatshirt. Once he told me that, I can't get that out of my head. But he said that, you know, it was mostly a lot of New York City kids.
What about this laughter at the beginning before the introduction starts? Anybody speculate about that?
Well, he was teaching there at the time, and he was not a large, imposing person. I only met him once. You know, I just assumed that there was some front of the stage theater going on that they were picking up on and feeling very comfortable with, because that's Paul. He is
right.
Our
so
Paul.
So I know what the theater was.
I think Al knows. Yeah.
I know what it is. Can we listen to the very beginning? The before the introduction?
I may as well do this for the... opening of the season.
Do this means he's putting on a Yankee hat.
Yeah. Oh.
Do that, yeah.
So he had in his bag for his reading a little dramatic prop, and it was a Yankee hat. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
It had to be that, yeah.
So let's go back to Cuba. So somebody, at least two of us, maybe all four of us, are reading this as a kind of political analog. Who wants to go with that?
I think one of the interesting things about doing politics like that in a poem is it's a way of just letting you know where his politics are in the poem about baseball, and not the kind of political poem that wants to tell you the truth or teach you and full of that kind of truth-telling ego, but... A kind of smaller, more humorous way of just expanding the scope of the poem. So,
Joel?
I think so. I mean, I just think it's really reflecting on what was in, you know, what just was so going on in that whole year. There was even the Havana Sugar Kings, which were the minor league team, were removed and placed in Jersey City for one season. So actually
wow.
the Havana...
And there's also Castro himself, who
Castro
was quite
himself.
A talented baseball player.
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, I think it is Castro was sort of famous of these pictures of him playing pickup baseball games and that kind of joke between Yankees and Yankee Go Home, which as a reader of Mad Magazine as a child, that was often made as a sort of point in the humor.
So if you have Blackburn's politics, you presumably... are rooting for the Yankees, the Empire, to lose. But he doesn't seem to be, because he's a Yankee fan.
Right. He is
so
a Yankee.
So this is conflicted.
It's part of the tragedy. There's a real tragedy of the poem. It's a tragedy of the inaccessible women. It's a tragedy of the team he's rooting for losing. It's the tragedy of the American Empire on the verge of collapse. And he manages to bring all three of these into a single focus and single perspective. But it's a comic poem about three layers of tragedy.
He's involved in the... He's culpable. He is an American. He cannot escape
right.
that.
Right, he is definitely...
He's culpable on several respects. Okay. One, he's a fan of the wrong side. He's a
exactly.
fan of the Empire.
Yeah.
Two, he's part yeah. of the masculinization that may be responsible for the whole catastrophe or its narrow vision is.
And he's a Yankees fan.
And he's a Yankees
how
fan.
Culpable, how culpable.
So I wonder if we can get a little more specific, because this World Series was very unusual in a couple of ways. Who wants to say
first? Well, I mean, you can find, if you want to go back onto YouTube, videos of this particular home run. Look for greatest home run of all time. And it is more than one clip of it are labeled in exactly those terms.
So let's make sure we say for our audience who may not know the...
In Bill Mazeroski, the Pirate second baseman...
Light hitting second baseman.
One of the poorest hitting infielders in the Hall of Fame, won the World Series in the seventh game in the bottom of the ninth with a walk-off home run that he hit off of Ralph Terry, who was the Yankee pitcher for that inning and the at least the inning before. It's the only World Series game in history, only World Series in history to have had its seventh game end on a home run, which is every child,
so-called walk-off,
every child's fantasy of, you know, coming up at the bottom right. of the ninth and the seventh inning and winning the World Series. This is the one person who actually lived that particular dream. It's also an unusual game in that Pittsburgh was a serious underdog. Pittsburgh was smoked in all three of the games they lost. The Yankees scored 10 or more runs three times in that series. Pittsburgh
won. The game
won,
before was maybe 10-0?
Yeah. Pittsburgh won no game by more than two runs. This one they won 10-9. It was the only time they actually scored a bunch of runs in that regard. It's also, and this is for the true baseball aficionado, still the only World Series game in history in which no player ever struck out.
So what do we do with all that information? Is it, are we tempted? This is the game. He's reading it in 1971. We're talking about it in 2012. Are the details of the game going to help us with the political analog, or is it just baseball people rattling on about fun facts?
How about both? I mean, I definitely think the politics of the baseball are game are built into it. It's also a significant event in the imaginative lives of New Yorkers. And one of the things that Paul Blackburn is, but also in a qualified way, is a real key New York figure of a particular generation. He's the person who started the St. Mark's Poetry Project, for example, not for another 6 years or so after this. And the year he's reading it in Cortland is, I believe, the last year of his life. I mean, I don't think he knows yet he's got esophageal cancer, but because I think that comes like in May or June, and it sounds like from the Mets game the day before the reading that must have been the last game of the preseason before the start of the season.
We know that. We know that because the Mets and Yankees in those days only played two games a year. One was the March 31st, the final game before the season, and another was a so-called Mayor's Trophy game. So we're placing it right at the end of March, well, April 1st. So, Daisy, where does he fit? You hear him. Is there a school? Is there a method? Is there a mode? Is there a style? He's hard to place, but here he seems to mark himself into familiar. What's your thought about that? What does he sound like?
What does he sound
like?
Does
he sound like a New York poet? Yeah. Does he sound like a beat? I mean, I hear a little Ferlinghetti talking about the Giants in this poem.
Yeah,
San Francisco Giants.
He is hard to place, and by way of sort of evading that question.
You are welcome to do that. You're my guest, and you may.
Sort of related to what does he sound like, and also this whole question of baseball is one of the things I noticed about this. I just said he keeps dropping numbers throughout the poem at pretty even intervals, and
so not just baseball numbers, but second and third avenues.
Second and third, and you've got the top of the sixth, and you've got, I mean, most of them are baseball numbers, but. One of the things I was looking at with this is, you know, I was thinking, you know, it's almost like stanza markers in a different poet, or the way some other sort of poet would use a sort of lattice of metaphor across the poem, you know. But that also just how appropriate it is that baseball is this numbers game, right? Because you couldn't do basketball like this. It wouldn't be appropriate, or soccer. Right. That's all more fluid. But if you've got baseball, the stats nerds in baseball, they don't really need to see the game. They can just look at the numbers and they get the whole story of the game.
You're a baseball fan, right?
A fake one, yeah. I am sometimes mean? For the purposes of journalism.
Have you ever
written
about baseball?
I once, years ago when I was working for the Philadelphia Weekly, I went to bars and interviewed guys about baseball.
So you
and
really
just sort
know
of wrote
about
down,
this.
Well, I don't know too much about
baseball. Did the dreamy jailbait line cause you to underscore or put an exclamation point or...
You know,
how do you feel about that line?
I had a kind of, those mid-century guys kind of feeling about it, you know. I mean, it just seems to be a thing amongst certain guys. I'm not to excuse them, but, you know, I thought of Kenneth Rexroth, who's, you know, marvelous
a lot older
politically,
than Blackburn,
and then he's just, like, sort of hideous about just middle-class
Blackburn
women of
a
certain
age. Blackburn has
a lot of
misogyny
yeah.
in his poetry, right? Ron, that's right.
Yeah, there's a lot of it there, you know, but he's by no means alone, and he's the same generation as somebody like Robert Creeley, who in a quick graph can actually have a sentence like, "All women enjoy rape, just ask one," you know, which got edited out of the collected essays for some obscure reason. but maybe he actually was suggested that he think twice about it.
So you think that Blackburn is in the normal range? Is that what you're saying,
Daisy? It's a little bit like discovering that all of the modernists were anti-Semites, including the ones who were Semites. You know.
All right, Daisy, I'm sorry. You were going in a different direction.
No, not really. It's just, you know, I mean, this is sort of the olden days, right? You know, I would like to think. so, as my daughter would say, it's the olden days. But it's unfortunate because it's these moments that aren't interesting. It's these moments that where there's, you know, there's not a performance of this attitude. It's just an unexamined attitude, and that's where the problem comes in.
What a nice day for all this. Handsome women, even dreamy jailbait, walk nearly neglected. Men's eyes are blank. Their thoughts are all in Pittsburgh. Last half of the ninth, the score tied 9-9. Mazeroski leads off for the Pirates. The second pitch, he simply, sweetly, crack, belts it clean over the left field wall.
We could talk a long time about this, but why don't we go around and invite each of ourselves to say one last thing about the poem or about what it suggests, starting with Joel. You got a final thought?
Actually, the thought I wanted to just to throw out is talking about why Blackburn isn't read as much
yeah, why
anymore.
Is that?
I think it's for lines like jailbait. I mean, I think this, you know, has affected his reading. As a younger poet, he seemed more available. I mean, you had The Cities, even though it was out of print, you could find everywhere for $1.99, and the two Black Sparrow books. And it almost seems that when The Collected came out, you know, which everyone who were fans, I know in New York, thought, oh, finally people will start reading him. It just seemed to mark this decline.
It didn't happen.
Yeah, it didn't really happen. I mean, there was a very negative review by Marjorie Perloff, if I'm not mistaken, which seemed to put a damper on things. But just his, you know, he really has kind of faded, you know, off the map in many ways.
And if his importance was partly because he was a poetry community person, his work with St. Mark's, his affiliation with NYU for some time, his poetry readings, that's the sort of thing that winds up fading.
Right.
Really.
It ends up fading. His collected poems come out from Persea, which is a press that sort of borders between being a trade press and a small press. His literary executor was M.L. Rosenthal, who I don't think had what I would call an appreciative understanding of his importance within the particular poetry community he came out of, and was simply trying to be nice to somebody who'd been a student of his once upon a time. And a number of the other key poets of his particular time and milieu either went in other directions, and to, you know, like Baraka or Edward Dorn, were either abandoning their poetics or turning on them of the 1950s, or like Charles Olson, who dies at essentially the same time Blackburn does in 1970, so that their influence gets truncated historically in those terms. So, yes, one of the reasons I really wanted to read this poem was precisely because I think Blackburn's an important voice that isn't heard nearly enough. And one of the great things about Penn Sound is that you can go and hear a fair amount of Paul Blackburn's work and maybe go back and find some of those books that should be republished. And I would agree with the Cities, the Collected and the Selected, and Journals, which Black Sparrow brought out, as well as the Provençal translations, and El Cid, which is still the best translation of that particular poem, which I have in a Cliff Notes version.
Wow, a Cliff Notes version.
They published his translation as a Cliff Notes volume.
That's extraordinary. I'd add a qualifier to the M.L. Rosenthal-Blackburn relationship. I read the correspondence between them in Rosenthal's archive at NYU in the Fales Library, and it's a deep connection. It's true, I think Rosenthal didn't quite understand the more radical elements of 60s poetry, but he did get him a job. It was a brief job as the poetry editor of The Nation magazine for maybe a year. And Rosenthal, he had been Rosenthal's student, and Rosenthal really went to bat for him, as it were. I'd also say about the Pensound thing that those, you're not only getting his voice, but you're getting these great readings, these exciting readings with a lot of people responding very well to Blackburn. Daisy, to you, a final thought on any of this?
I've just been thinking about some of the famous baseball poems. I mean, this is a very sports poem. Poets write sports poems that tend to be very non-physical, right? They're poems in which people are watching sports, right?
Right, like William Cross Williams in Spring and All is talking about the crowd, not about the players.
Exactly right. And although I would note on the women issue, he does have a woman in there who knows, you know, in the crowd. And
Williams does.
Yeah, he's talking. It's
at the ballpark or at the ball game.
The crowd at the. Yeah. The crowd of the ball game is the, right.
He's worried that and the crowd turns that might turn fascist. He's
it's
worried.
Kind of this it's dread of fascism.
A, yeah.
What is it, 1921 or something?
Spring and All is 23. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's before the rise of fascism, but.
But there's some sort of prophetic thing going
oh,
on.
Oh, it's
there,
a
right?
scary
and,
poem.
And,
yeah.
And but the woman knows and the Jew knows in there and, right. and so he's got. I'm kind of circling back around to this thing about the women in the middle of this poem,
who are left. Almost alone, nearly alone.
Yeah, who are left alone, but you know, the men in here are, the women in here are just physical objects, but the men in here don't really have much of a physical existence either.
They're
just
watching.
In their pockets, right? Their own pockets are in the TV, which is, you know, I just think of poems now that are written about public events, where a lot of those events are actually experienced through media. But that goes unacknowledged in the poems, or something here. And one of the really charming things to me about this is that it does reject the physical experience. That it is just the transistor radio and the numbers, and it's moving away from the physical completely, while still being just
which
this
may be a sign of what postdates the empire. Maybe there's a new way of less. Physical militarism and more spectatorship. I don't know. Yay, spectatorship.
Shooting missiles from some room somewhere
from
far away.
From a room somewhere, yeah.
But
yeah.
It is a communal experience.
Yeah.
I mean,
this
you know,
is.
I mean,
it's,
I mean,
it's
I mean,
urban
I,
and communal.
I mean, yeah. At the time, and I think for a younger reader, wouldn't really realize that in those days, the American League, National League finished the series and they went immediately into the World Series. There was no elaborate playoffs. He went mm-hmm. right away.
And early October.
Early October, and it often happened during the Jewish holidays. And to reduce the tension in our synagogue, the sexton would come out and announce the score periodically to keep people from...
A reform synagogue, no doubt.
Or Orthodox, because people would go outside and ask people, okay. Gentiles walking down the street, hey, what's the score? You know, and then, you know, so to keep that kind of drift, the you know, they would announce, you know, particularly if the Yankees, you know, were in the series. But I'm saying it is this communal thing. You have these pictures of people watching television sets inside appliance stores, or people asking people what's the score going on, you know. And I think so it's kind of like a communal, although, I mean, I find that line interesting about transistor radios. Is this the first appearance a transistor radio makes in a poem?
That's entirely possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of this advance of this.
Joe, you are so cool. You offered a sociogeography of the students of Cortland circa 1971. You're referring to the Orthodox Jews going outside to get. Now you're talking about the first instance of the transistor radio. I love you. Where have you been all my life?
In Hoboken.
You're like a human. Hoboken. That's the rate.
Because it's, you know, I mean, the transistor radio must have just come on, you know, it's this new. It was like, as you said, like the iPod, you know, kind of this new technology that you could, you know.
It replaced crystal sets. If you remember them.
It enabled all of us to have them under our pillows and also to have them in our desks at school. Ron, your final thought.
My final thought is that this is only the fourth poem Paul Blackburn wrote in 1960. He only wrote seven poems all year.
And you know counted the...
I have counted. Jerome collected lists the year of writing and the year of publication.
So what happened?
Why? I don't know. It's not apparent when I look at the journals, when I look at the translations, what else he was doing. I know he was in Holland earlier in the year, simply because the very first poem that year is set there. But, you know, it's a very quiet year, and this is actually the hinge poem. There's three poems in front of it and three poems after it, and somehow he gets to at least October 13th with just three pages of poetry. And for somebody who wrote as much every day as Paul Blackburn did, there's a story there that I certainly have not yet unpacked.
For all of us, that would be interesting. For you, Ron Silliman in particular, who tries to write every day, it's just astonishing to think of someone relatively prolific not writing. Can you imagine not writing for... Can you imagine only writing 10 pages in a year?
Only under the effects of, psychiatric medications and restraints.
Thank you. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Who wants to gather a little paradise first? Joel.
Well, not a poem, not the book of poetry, but something in terms of social. I've been reading Tony Judt.
J-U-D-T?
Yeah, J-U-D-T. I think it's called Rethinking the 20th Century. And if he died of Lou Gehrig's disease, and Timothy Snyder, who's a Holocaust historian, and like 20 years his junior, a close friend, would come down every week from Yale and talk with him. And it's this amazing performance. I mean, in terms of performative thing, because the man cannot move. And it's just, all of this is just coming out of pure memory, but also just kind of a really interesting biography, social history, commentary about social democracy, Marxism, and world history. It's just a really readable and amazing performance.
The title of the book?
I think it's called Rethinking the 20th Century. It's a Penguin... Terrific. Penguin book.
Daisy, Gather Some Paradise.
One of the books I've been very excited about and going back to a lot was Selected Poems of Roy Fisher that came out last year. The British poet Roy Fisher, who's been completely unknown except probably people in this room know him.
He's great.
He's read, but sort of... ignored a lot in America, and like many wonderful people. But August Klein Zoller did a selection for Wave Books last year, and it's quite an exciting book. So I just recommend it.
Great. Can I also, on your behalf, recommend that Poem Talk listeners go to the Poetry Foundation website and look for your stint as a, do we say, blogger?
Yeah, every year they call back all the old bloggers for...
National Poetry Month for a reprise.
And
so if we go there and we just search your name, we're likely to find that series of commentaries.
For better or for worse, yeah.
For better, Daisy. I just want to report happily that Penn Sound on its Larry Eigner page now includes a fairly rare recording made in 1971 in Massachusetts of Eigner reading for about 17 minutes. And if you go to Penn Sound's Eigner page, you're going to find someone who, while because of his physical disabilities, was not going to play but maybe listen to baseball, doing a fabulous job of reading given his limitations. So that's all the Yankees on base we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writers House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation. poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests Joel Lewis, Daisy Freed, and Ron Silliman, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer Chris Martin, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Maria Damon, Craig Dworkin, and Brian Reed join me to talk about Clark Coolidge's poem Blues for Alice. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for that or another Poem Talk.